Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name's Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have Ben Chipkin, who is a future doctor medical student at Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. And he did his master's degree in biochemical and molecular nutrition with me at Friedman at Tufts University. And he has a lot of interest in nutrition and medicine and sustainability and the intersection of those fields. He also recently did a TEDx talk called The Culinary Art of Medicine, which you can find on YouTube. We're really glad to have you, Ben. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Noah and Emily, for having me on today. I'm so excited to talk food, sustainability, and medicine.
That's what we do here. So I think the first way we always start these podcasts is to learn a little about how you came into doing what you're doing and what your core focus is right now. So what was sort of the beginning of the journey for you to, let's say, end up where we are here and to be in a position to give TED Talks?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And for me, it kind of all starts from the time I was a little kid. You know, I grew up eating a lot of garbage food. I grew up eating my famed recipe of two waffles with peanut butter and bologna between them. And I was by no means the healthiest kid growing up. I struggled a lot with my weight and, you know, my self-esteem growing up. And I felt like as I grew older and got to college, I really found nutrition and exercise as a means for building some more confidence and feeling better about myself, as well as being able to give back to others. So nutrition really was kind of how I found my way into medicine as well. I went to Tufts University with Emily and got my master's in nutrition. And I realized that I really wanted to be helping people one-on-one with their diet, helping them with exercise, and helping them to just live overall healthier lives. And that's what kind of steered me towards the medical school route. And here I am, a third year medical student, and trying to bring nutrition into the day-to-day of my rotations as much as I can.
Fantastic. And we think that's honestly, unfortunately, a rare thing to hear from people in the medical field. I think there's a lot of focus, and there's always been a lot of focus on using medicine to heal disease rather than sort of to live a healthy lifestyle. So that sort of shift is important to understand. And just from my own experience, hearing about what gets taught in medical school, there may not be a whole lot of nutrition. So it's great to walk into that with a master's and really know it from the bottom to the top.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. It's not something that we talk about on the daily, even on my clinical rotations. It's not something that we learn a lot about in the classroom setting in our first couple of years in medical school. I think on average, medical schools have about 20 hours of nutrition education throughout the 4 years. So it's pretty sparse. And, yeah, you know, even that, I don't really see much in terms of practical nutrition education coming to my medical school.
Sure. Sure.
So the emerging field of what is called culinary medicine is very interesting to me. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so it's super exciting to me. Culinary medicine is essentially the idea that rather than trying to teach doctors about the biochemistry of nutrition, about macro and micronutrient profiles, rather than teaching them about that, culinary medicine says that we should teach doctors how to cook. And the idea is that if doctors know how to cook and feel comfortable with food, you know, particularly with cooking fresh fruits and vegetables, then they'll be more able to actually teach their patients how to cook with fresh fruits and vegetables and to eat in a healthier way.
Great. Yeah. And in your experience, in your rotations, for example, do you see that doctors are not, they don't know how to cook, or they're not valuing food as part of their lifestyle?
Yeah, I love the way you ask that question. Immediately, my mind goes to our 10-minute lunch break when we're not really told that we have time to eat, but unspoken, you know, we have 10 minutes to run down to the cafeteria, look around, there's horrific food options, and you know, a lot of doctors, medical students, nurses, you know, everyone in the hospital, we're all gathering in the cafeteria to consume some pretty unhealthy food. So I think, you know, that in and of itself really speaks to how low on kind of our minds food is throughout the day. It's really not something that I see many people, you know, bringing their own meals to work or thinking that they have time to cook for themselves. So it's pretty scary.
So, yeah. So how are you going about changing that? Or how do you think that we can change that? It's, to some extent, it's a systemic issue with the way the rotations are and the way medicine is practiced, right? So what do you think that you can do, or what are you trying to do to change that culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's, you know, kind of beaten like a dead horse, but medicine is incredibly time intensive. We spend hours upon hours training, studying, hours in the hospital. And in reality, it is difficult to find the time to cook. And for me, it's really something that needs to become a priority from a personal standpoint. You really need to make that time for yourself to prepare meals ahead of time, or at least sort of think through, you know, where can I get a healthy meal around a hospital. But I think, you know, the way that in my daily life I try to inspire those around me is to just, you know, live by doing that and bringing my own healthy meals, kind of eating them in front of my peers and getting them to question what the heck is in my bowl and what am I eating today. I think that's one way to kind of make a small change. But from a more systemic point of view, I think we really need to start getting things like culinary medicine into medical school curriculums. We need people to be told by their professors, by people in, you know, places of authority, that food is really important. And then we need to, you know, substantiate that with real evidence. So there have been some studies that have shown that doctors who know how to cook and doctors who eat healthier and live generally healthier lifestyles actually are better able to guide their patients to a more healthier life and able to offer them better healing as physicians. So I think it's kind of important that we also bring that data into this space and say, you know, this isn't just some philosophical thing. There's actually evidence that this helps both doctors and their patients.
In some ways, I can't believe we're having the conversation of doctors should be healthy, because that seems like common sense. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we see all over the place. There was, for a long time, doctors smoked in hospitals. I mean, we had to fix that because there wasn't always a clear connection between how the doctor was behaving and the medical outcomes they were attempting to create. So it's now moved on. Thankfully, there's no more smoking in operating rooms, but the modern equivalent is, you know, an obese doctor counseling someone on heart disease. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly really interesting, and it's certainly an interesting juxtaposition to see doctors who are not promoting and living healthy lifestyles trying to counsel their patients to do so. And there is some evidence that that might not be good for the patients. To counter that point a little bit, though, I think there has been this growing sentiment to that we just be sort of careful about how we approach this and not alienate physicians who are obese or you know, not living healthy lifestyles at this point. And I guess my hope is that we can create a culture in medicine that like more enables doctors to live the healthier lifestyle that I'm guessing most of them want to be living, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm.
Sure, sure. There is a constraint placed by the system, which is crazy hours, crazy expectations, that is not exactly compatible always with the stress-free, well-nutrition-styled lifestyle that we need to see. That's true.
Totally, totally.
Do you think it's... I mean, I've heard varying arguments about this. Do you think that with all of the stuff that's already on medical students' plates, like, do they have time to learn more about nutrition? I mean, do you see something else that could be cut out, or like a different way that maybe you know, just theoretically, you think would be a better way to learn or something that you could cut out? Because there's this growing, okay, well, if doctors can't help us with nutrition, then that's why we have nutritionists, right? And they're the experts in nutrition, and we can leave that to them. And
yeah, I mean, the, you know, the way you're phrasing that, it's, it almost points out that it's really like a catch-22. You know, I'm over here saying let's add more nutrition education, but at the same time, I'm talking about how we don't have enough time as doctors to take care of ourselves. So,
right.
I think you know, you point out something that's really, really important, that it's going to take a more global look at nutrition education to really determine where we can eliminate some of the minutiae that isn't so essential in clinical practice. And I think there is a fair deal of that we see, in especially in our first and second year of medical school, where typically we're learning more of the traditional textbook sciences, biochemistry, immunology. And to be honest, those are sort of the things that doctors tend to forget first, I think. You know, they're not so clinically mm-hmm. applicable in our day-to-day. And if you really need to know that sort of information, then, you know, within your specialty, then you're probably going to learn it in residency or throughout your training. So, I mean, I think that's really the place where we can try to adjust and move towards including more nutrition education. But now we also have our board examinations, which focus on that minutia. And, you know, the board exams are what determine which specialty we can go into, where we do our residency. So, you know, unfortunately, I think the importance that's placed on board exams also sort of detracts from the ability of medical schools to innovate and really drive change in this area.
Are there any schools that buck that trend that you're aware of, or are you pretty much pigeonholed into doing it a certain way if you are to be an accredited school?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of schools that I think are doing a pretty awesome job in terms of culinary medicine, at least. Tulane is a big one. A lot of people know they have a dedicated center for culinary medicine, and they have actually built a lot of infrastructure around culinary medicine. I think they're doing a really fabulous job in bringing cooking to their students and as well as their community. And, you know, I think a lot of schools like my own are hesitant to put their money where their mouth is and actually build a culinary medicine kitchen on site. That's been something I've really struggled with my 3 years here at Jefferson, which I love, but they can do better.
Yeah, they can all do better. Well, that's interesting about Tulane. Cool.
Yeah.
Definitely put a link to them in the podcast description so folks can check that out. It's a good little plug for Tulane.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I mean, you know, we're being very negative. I mean, I do think that there is a culture where food and preventative medicine are becoming more popular in general. I think hopefully the culture is shifting a little bit more toward that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, I try my best to keep up on the current literature in nutrition, but it's hard with my schedule right now. Looking at the past couple months of New England Journal of Medicine has been publishing a lot more on nutrition. And I think a lot of big journals in general have been moving more towards getting this preventative medicine science out there to doctors. I think in general, we are starting to talk more about food and medicine. And there are a lot of physicians on Instagram now, for better or worse, who are talking about nutrition. A lot of sort of popular science physicians who are out there talking about, you know, everything from plant-based diets to keto diets. And opinions aside, I do think that it's good that doctors are out there starting to talk about nutrition more.
We certainly see that happen. I think almost every podcast we're making some sort of snarky comment about there being a lot of information out there on social media, but it's coming from sources that may or may not be reputable. So there's a real push to see some of this come from better places, and obviously doctors would be a good spot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually one of the gastroenterologists at Jefferson, his name is Dr. Austin Chang. He actually has founded a new organization that focuses on monitoring and legitimizing doctors who go in the social media space and talk about, you know, anything related to medicine. But I think it's good that we kind of see that doctors are understanding, you know, there's a lot of information out there. Some of it is good, some of it's really problematic. And I hope that we can get a better grip on it through these new social media organizations that are springing up that are really hoping to provide some sort of oversight and ensure that the public is not getting bamboozled.
That's really cool. We'll look into that. Just our last episode, we were just talking about how science communication is really big on Twitter now. So it's kind of the same idea where like a lot of scientists, PhD scientists are using Twitter to get information out there. I think because there are so many people that are on these platforms that are uneducated about the stuff that they're talking about, that we really do need like doctors and scientists to be on these platforms. But yeah, for sure, there are other considerations. So how exactly, you said he's doing some sort of regulation or monitoring of these doctors that are on social media, or how? It sounds interesting. I'm not exactly sure how that would work, though.
Yeah, so I think his idea was, which he is following through on now, he's created sort of a national organization where health professionals can come together and say, you know, we're joining this organization. I unfortunately can't remember the exact name right now, but essentially it's a community of doctors, dietitians, nurses who are saying, we're on social media platforms and we are going to self-regulate ourselves. We're going to ensure that things that we post on social media are held to a higher standard. So I think sort of the membership in this organization is how they're getting buy-in, but how exactly they'll be monitoring, I think that's still an open question and unfortunately might not be incredibly feasible.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I guess it's not really as much monitoring and regulation. It's just giving those doctors like credibility by coming together with an organization. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, a step in the right direction.
Of course, as with all social media, whoever makes the most noise and gets the word out there is the one that actually controls the narrative. So starting out at a point like this and just being willing to get people together and do that is literally all it takes to get the wheels turning.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think it's a great point. You know, there's always going to be people who are posting nonsense and being dishonest on social media. But as long as we're starting to talk more about it, it's moving in the right direction. We have to make sure people are wary on there.
Right. This is kind of unrelated, but it's related to something you were saying before about in the New England Journal of Medicine, there's more nutrition and preventative medicine type articles, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've seen in the past few months, even there was a big article on projections of obesity in 2030. You know, seeing the trends in the prevalence of both moderate obesity and severe morbid obesity. And then there was an article talking about intermittent fasting that got a lot of traction and a lot of discussion about that, even among my fellow medical students here at Jefferson.
Yeah.
There was a recent article about dairy. And you know, these might not be directly nutrition studies, but they're, you know, starting to at least bring that into the conversation, I think.
Yeah, that's great. And I might be interested in your opinion on intermittent fasting, if you have an opinion on that. But the other thing I was going to say is there's now a Nature Food Journal. I don't know if you heard about that. It was like in the past year, and the dean of the Friedman School published something in the first edition. That's pretty cool that there's an entire journal dedicated, like a well-known journal dedicated to food, and I think that includes both medicine and a lot from like environmental and sustainability and food systems, and I'm just excited there's a journal called Nature Food.
Me too. I mean, that
I don't know if you had heard about that. Did you?
No, I had. Yeah, I have not. I don't know if I've read Nature Food, but
there's only one edition, I think, so far.
Oh, really?
It's brand new. It's brand new. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll have to keep following along because that does make me super excited. I mean, I think it's awesome. I think, you know, we've heard for years and years that there's no way to do legitimate nutrition research and all the research is conflicting, which might be true in a sense, but I think it's important that we at least, you know, say nutrition research is mainstream scientific research and it does have a place among those clinical trials of a new antibiotic or a new pharmaceutical drug.
That's a great perspective.
Yeah, and I think in terms of intermittent fasting, so most medical students do by default intermittent fast, but just kidding. But I think my opinion isn't fully formulated on it. I think it does have a lot of potential in terms of promoting longevity. I have seen that there have been, you know, a number of links to benefits for obesity, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain cancers in terms of impairing energy metabolism and activating a number of protective transcription factors. There has been a lot of research into intermittent fasting that seems promising. I don't know that it's necessarily practical for everyone. You know, people say that once you get through the first month of intermittent fasting, it gets a lot easier, but I tend to get a little hangry, so I don't know how that first month would go. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, it has potential, but I tend to come from the mindset that there's no one-size-fits-all nutrition solution. And I think if it works for people, I think that's great. You know, there have been some really interesting links to improved health and longevity, so I don't really see much in terms of problems at this point.
Cool.
That's a pretty safe response, but I think is completely fair. I think it is definitely early to give a scientific perspective on it. I need to be more studies done in a really authoritative environment. I think my main hang-up with it would be, and I think our professional opinion here at the podcast is, it's being promoted largely by people without rigorous scientific backgrounds. Mm. Really heavy, well-researched, degree-based individuals, you know?
Yeah.
So it can definitely be a bit of a challenge to project that as any sort of a lifestyle that everyone should be ascribing to. But there's been really interesting, I think, developments from it in getting people to have good health outcomes starting from a really bad place. It can be a really powerful, really rapid sort of change maker in people that otherwise are having a real bad time nutritionally.
And I think you could say a similar thing about the ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to give your perspective on that, but right, originally that was a medical diet, right?
Right, yeah. So I totally agree. I think, you know, when we talk about a lot of these diets, you know, they might have been shown to have benefits in a very specific, potentially unhealthy population. Mm-hmm. And I think that is certainly so important. And the ketogenic diet, again, you know, comes from studies done on kids with epilepsy and preventing seizures, for which it's an incredibly effective therapy. But I think people have sort of run with that science and maybe adapted it in a way that doesn't really accurately depict what we know about the ketogenic diet. It's something I'm pretty skeptical of at this point in terms of what we know about it. And it's not something that I would really be recommending to anyone other than a kid with severe refractory epilepsy, which is, you know, where we do have really strong, good evidence.
That's a good point. I think the biggest risk of what we're saying is that essentially our answer here today is pretty boring. Our answer is let's wait for the research. And that's not a compelling thing to have media about, largely to get projected out there in the sort of bite-size, interesting, if it bleeds, it leads kind of stories that are out there right now. So the challenge is making that kind of perspective make more sense to people that are consuming media in a way that really caters well to magic bullet cures.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
that's a gap.
I couldn't agree more. It's it's very boring to say eat more fruits and vegetables,
right, exactly.
And that tends to be my perspective. And it's it's something that people in medicine sort of say with a sense of sort of like an arrogance at this point. It's not really something that's taken seriously when you say it at this point from my perspective. So it's certainly boring, but I think it's something that we know is probably good for everyone.
Sure. And there's another important point here, which is anytime that you sort of snap someone out of a pattern of eating that may not be the best for them, you might be improving their health just by default, right? So telling someone to make some big change might just by accident remove some really negative factor in their diet, which I think is partially what happens when people switch over to, let's say, a diet that's lower in carbs. They're cutting out a lot of processed, super carby, sugary foods, and that whole scenario just makes them healthier off the bat.
Right, absolutely. And, we see even in reading nutrition studies, you always sort of see in the discussions of the limitations of these studies, mm-hmm. They'll say, we can't say whether or not this effect is caused by that this population is healthier in general or makes healthier decisions about food and exercise that sort of coincide with whatever variable they're actually studying in the research study. So I feel like those confounding variables that sort of get at how healthy choices tend to sort of aggregate together. It's hard to parse that out.
Yeah, it definitely is. And just in general, back to sort of the mission of our podcast, eating more sustainable, healthy, well-produced, well-sourced, not adulterated foods will pretty much just always be better for you than eating processed junk.
Right. So absolutely.
It's sort of a magic bullet there, essentially. But that answer, again, is not very interesting to people. That's not going to be something that ever crops up on the news as a miracle cure. Because it's just eat your fruits and vegetables and make sure they weren't covered in pesticides and grown to have no nutritional value. So it's definitely something we need to be projecting and even might be challenging to get into the medical literature, get into the medical practice, because that just seems so obvious to people. And it may just not be in the way that people are teaching it yet. It's hard to codify that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not sexy. It's not something that you can make a ton of money off of.
Right.
And I think, therefore it really just sits there as, we sort of know what to do at this point. There's obviously a lot more nuance to work out within nutrition science, but in my opinion, we do know a healthy way to eat and live more sustainably and in a way that prevents disease. But I think, like you're saying, it's just really, it's not something that anybody's super interested in.
Yeah.
Unless you're shopping at Whole Foods, of course.
Right, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that touches on something that interests me a lot, which is we did this master's, right, in like nutrition, but really focused on like the biochemistry and like the nitty gritty of nutrition. And I kind of feel conflicted sometimes because it's like, yeah, I do think we generally know what to do, right? Eat more fruits and vegetables is a general sort of good public health guideline. You should say, though, right, that you think we should pursue the nuance in nutrition science research. And we talked to her from the Inside Tracker.
Oh, Catherine.
Catherine. So we talked to her, right? And Inside Tracker is this like super personalized nutrition company, and people are coming to them to look at very specific biomarkers, like how can I on an individual level like optimize what I'm eating. And I kind of go back and forth about, like, I think, does everybody need that? I guess that's the question.
Yeah,
it can be, it originally was being used for a lot of athletes and stuff. And if you have a particular interest in health, I can see how it would be interesting. And it's very interesting to me, the different biomarkers, but it's like overall, how much is that the nuance of understanding nutrition research helping society be healthier overall?
I mean, I think
it's a hard
even
question.
In listening to that podcast, I kind of had similar conflicting thoughts. I think my own curiosity as a scientist and medical student is, I want to know this stuff. I want to know what these minor adjustments in biomarkers mean for health. But, you know, when I take a step back, it's like, I don't know that that's necessarily accessible to a broad population. I think right now it's, you know, that's certainly something that is really available to wealthy people and people who have time to think about what they're eating and people who have that privilege. So, you know, in my opinion, I think it's awesome. I think it's really cool and interesting, but I don't really see it as the way to shift our, you know, our obesity epidemic, our diabetes epidemic. I don't really think that that's the way that we're going to do it.
If I can interject from the sort of technology world, I think it reminds me of the 80-20 rule in productivity research, which is essentially that, maybe it's sort of a relationship to that rule, it's not exactly that rule. The point being, you're going to get most of the way to where you want to go with 20% of the time and effort that you put in. You're going to basically get 80% of the way to where you want to be. And it's going to require another magnitude of effort again to get that final 20% for a perfect 100. So really, general nutritional guidelines would get a lot of people to a better place, to a much higher plateau of health and fitness and nutrition. And that sort of individualized perspective and really looking at biomarkers, looking at individual nutritional specific guidelines, that would get you another step above that. And that's something that really someone who's already at the top of their fitness game might benefit from, more than, say, someone who needs sort of all of the ordinary improvements first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, I'm thinking about even in terms of how our healthcare and insurance landscape might shift. You know, something like Inside Tracker might become more accessible to the general public.
Sure.
For operating in, you know, a more nationalized healthcare system, no matter your opinion of that. And, you know, on the other hand, I look at something like that and I think we spend so much money on healthcare in this country. And I think it's important that we don't do testing on people who don't need it. And, you know, unless we can find some compelling evidence that getting these blood biomarkers on 330 million people in this country, then I don't know that, you know, we really should be doing so. From an economic standpoint, maybe our money is better spent elsewhere.
I'm sure the company selling the data from those blood biomarkers would love to say that it's necessary.
Definitely.
It's a whole nother issue, but data security.
Totally. Oh yeah.
But no, I mean, I think that's a good perspective that I hadn't really thought about before. So let's switch gears a little bit to just sustainability. How do you think that doctors can, I mean, through sustainable food, but just in general sustainability, like, what do you think the doctors or health professionals' role is in promoting sustainability and you know, specifically like environmental sustainability?
Sure, yeah. So this is really my other passion in medical school, is trying to create a more sustainable health system. And, you know, for me, I think it really is our role as doctors to be out there and trying to fight against things like climate change, things like poor land use and excessive water use. And I think it really is something that we're talking about even less than nutrition and medicine.
Yeah.
We do not talk about sustainability in medicine. We did get one 50-minute lecture in my school about sustainability. It was not well attended. I remember, you know, sitting there and just thinking to myself, like, I hope I'm not the only one who cares about this, and I know my classmates care about this deeply, but why aren't we there when we need to be? So I think, you know, it's important for doctors for a number of different reasons. So climate change is changing the landscape of disease, particularly in terms of infectious disease spread, mm-hmm. you know, as the climate shifts, so too do where viruses and bacteria head. So I think in terms of infectious disease, that's incredibly important. In terms of the food that we grow and eat, how climate change will shift our diet will have an impact on chronic disease, on diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease. So I think it's sort of silly that we're not paying more attention to this. It's something that we're going to have to deal with. My, you know, upcoming batch of physicians, we're going to be the ones who are faced with this problem in the healthcare setting. So we need to be talking more about it and doing more about it.
Awesome.
We basically couldn't agree more, and even more so than food. It takes a backseat to other discussions because it's just not sexy enough for modern media. And people just aren't willing to look at themselves and look at their choices and say, maybe this isn't the right thing.
Well, I mean, I would argue the word sustainability is all over modern media, but it's like people aren't taking it to heart. But right. It's very trendy. Maybe
media that we see. Yeah,
maybe just because we're in California. Right. I don't know.
That's the
worry. I think it's getting more popular. But it's just the problem is people don't know what it means, or like they don't take it to heart, or...
It's putting things into practice also, really.
It's something I see as a huge problem even within hospitals. You know, we produce so much waste in hospitals. It's horrifying. I mean, a lot of it is at this point medically necessary, to especially for prevention of infection transmission, and just from a cleanliness standpoint, it is, you know, important. But when you sit in an OR and see the amount of garbage that's produced throughout one surgical procedure, mm-hmm. it's pretty mind-boggling, and no one's really taking the initiative to do something about it at this point. So I think it is a problem that we can tackle. You know, we're looking at waste as an issue more broadly in this country, but we're not really talking about it in terms of medical waste at this point.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. I mean, from the food side too, it's kind of similar, I think, in the medical context. Like, there's this very fine balance between safety and waste reduction, right? Because, you know, if the food or the medical care that you're getting has a higher chance of being unsafe, you know, that's very important. We have to, like, very highly consider that, I would say, over waste reduction at this point. So something I'm interested in, right, is creating biomaterials. I'm sure there are a lot of plastic things that you mm-hmm. use or bandages in hospitals that are wasted, that if we could create some sort of biodegradable material that could be used instead.
Right. Yeah, totally. I agree. I think, you know, it's really going to take some serious design thinking to get us out of this situation, because I don't know if this has been studied or looked at, but I imagine the hospitals are some of the bigger waste producers in a lot of communities. So I think you're totally spot on. We need to start thinking about how we can make these materials, these, you know, mostly plastic materials, into either biodegradable or multi-use objects, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge piece of it. And from a material science perspective, I think the real challenge is always just cost. All of these options surely exist, but I'm guessing it basically is more efficient for the hospital to do whatever is effective at a certain price point and then disposable, because there's essentially no internalized cost to producing all that waste. Garbage pickup is very, very, very cheap per ton or per, you know, per day, whatever it is. So there's essentially no penalty for doing that. And that's how it is for household waste as well. You can throw as much as you possibly can into those bins every week, and they'll pick them up. So as soon as they bring that cost back from being external to internal, that's going to require some legislation of some kind to make the producers of the waste feel some sort of burden from creating it. Otherwise, it basically makes no sense to do better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love your point. We're so disconnected from the trash that we make. You know, we in the OR, we pile everything into these big biohazard bags, mm-hmm. and someone comes and grabs them, and we go on to the next case. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that we see. It's not something that we think about after we're done. So it's a huge issue.
And it may even have stemmed partially from safety, in that there's 100% chance you won't reuse a dirty instrument if it's gone after the procedure. So
right.
There's a little bit of that. I know there were big hospitals a number of years ago who themselves have now switched to single-use items, but were like autoclaving or heat sterilizing, chemically sterilizing things. And if you messed up which cart something was on, suddenly you were reusing scalpels. And that just can't happen. So there's got to be a way to figure out how to either solve it from one of these perspectives that makes sense. But I think new materials, just a better sense of what goes in and out of any building or environment, that's got to be part of that thought process. And it's part of the thought process for food. What goes in and out of the body? That's how you figure out what's partially sustainable for human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's also sort of these ideas that we have in medicine that certain things can't be reused or it will pose a risk to patients. And a lot of times that may or may not be evidenced, actually. I do, anecdotally, there is a professor at Jefferson who expresses to the students that when we insert Foley catheters, which is essentially to prevent incontinence for patients, it does not actually need to be done in a sterile fashion, and that doing that in a sterile fashion actually doesn't change the risk of infection to patients. So there might be certain things that we do as physicians sterilely that don't need to be done sterilely and therefore produce more waste than is actually medically necessary. So I think whether or not that is actually the case is kind of beside my point, but I think it's important that we really think hard about what is medically necessary and what is not, and that may help us reduce our waste in a minor capacity, but it's the kind of steps that we do need to be taking.
One, slightly gross. Two, fascinating.
Yes. Couldn't be a doctor.
No, I certainly wouldn't be. It really does point to the fact that we're obeying a lot of procedures in the medical world that really have this sort of ironclad bureaucratic sense to them, and that if you were to go against that procedure to save money, time, resource, whatever it be, you'd be the strange one, the odd one out, right? If you were disobeying that sort of tried and true method.
Right, exactly. That kind of conventional wisdom is not to be questioned,
right.
I would say.
Right.
And also, I mean, it probably increases your risk of being sued, right? There's legal considerations. So
totally, right. Yeah. And, you know, medical malpractice kind of plays into everything we've talked about in terms of sustainability. That defensive medicine is, it's huge and it's practiced everywhere. You know, everyone's afraid of being sued, and you know, the fear is legitimate in some sense, but something needs to be changed about that.
Yeah, certainly. It goes right back to the point of essentially externalizing all of the costs of that. There's basically only a benefit to being extremely wasteful if it decreases likelihood of being sued. That's a clear benefit.
So, right, totally. Yeah, that's the incentive, is to use more plastic and produce more waste, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no award for the hospital that produces the least plastic, you know?
Right.
Well, there should be.
There should be. Yes.
Yeah.
Start that.
Definitely. Yeah. I think it's, you know, kind of interesting that we're even talking about waste in medicine, because I talked to Emily about this before, but I'm part of a group of physicians and future doctors called Physicians for Social Responsibility, and they focus a lot on climate change in medicine and things like air quality and asthma. And even within that space, we don't really talk about waste in medicine. So I think it's really nice to be able to talk about that with you guys.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah, I do wonder if we're one of the only, you know, media outlets that are now having these types of conversations. It's something that makes so much sense, but only if you value the health of your planet and people over the long period of time.
Right.
And that's, I agree, challenging to put into financial terms. It is.
Totally. Absolutely.
It really is. Mm-hmm.
Well, so do you have anything else you wanted to share? I was going to put the link to your TED Talk, but is there anything else you wanted us to share? Or
I don't think so. I mean, I'm so, so happy that we were able to talk today.
Great.
It's just great to be able to talk nutrition and talk food, because I don't get to do it enough. And I think it's important that, you know, as a future doctor, I do that on the daily.
Oh, I forgot. What specialty are you thinking about? Or something related to nutrition? Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I'm planning to be a gastroenterologist. So that will entail going to residency for internal medicine and then applying to a GI fellowship. And I think digestive disease and things related to gut health are super interesting. And it's a really rapidly expanding field. A lot of links to sustainability and nutrition. So I think it's where I'm headed.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's a great spot to be. I think, unfortunately, I see great job security for you there.
Yeah, sadly. Sadly enough.
There's a lot of people that need that kind of thing. There'll be a lot of work for you there. Yeah. I think we can definitely spend another hour, you know, talking about how food applies to human health, and we're going to keep doing that with other people, and we'd love to have you back on in the future and do more of that.
Awesome. Yeah, I would love to talk to you guys again. Yeah.
And just the microbiome is just an entire topic itself.
Oh, yeah.
The gut microbiome.
Yeah.
Oh,
so. Yeah. I didn't want to say the word because I knew it could open up a huge can of worms. But
okay. Maybe next time.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us. This has been the Evolution Eats podcast. Signing off.